Molecular machines are what excites my next guest. Synthetic machines that operate at the molecular level. David Lee is the Royal Society Research Professor and Chair of Chemistry at the University of Manchester. He's in New Zealand to address a conference on advanced materials and nanotechnology in Queenstown. He's festooned with awards, Professor Lee, and his main research interest is the design of what are called molecular level architectures, including knots. He's in our Christchurch studio. Hello.
Hi, Kim.
How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Natural molecular motion is going on all the time, right? Everything we see in nature has got some kind of molecular motion going on. How would we create useful synthetic molecular motion?
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, the whole reason that we know that it's possible to shrink machines down to the molecular level is there already is a working nanotechnology out there. It's called biology. So nature actually uses molecular machines in every conceivable biological process, from harvesting energy from the sun to the way that DNA replicates to the way our muscles move. Every single process in biology uses molecular machines. And in contrast, at the start of the 21st century, despite our myriad of technologies that we have today, we just rely upon the static properties of molecules and materials for their function. And biology hasn't evolved over 2.5 billion years to use molecular machines for everything for no good reason. And when we learn how to do the same, it will completely revolutionise our whole approach to what we can do with molecules and materials.
So you're talking about synthetic molecular motors, but what does that mean? I mean, motors in the motion sense rather than the tiny little combustion engines, not right?
No, not tiny little combustion engines, because actually the way that matter behaves at different size scales is very different. So my glass of water in front of me is in the big world, of course, and that's just going to sit on the table unless I happen to knock it off with my hand. But if that was a molecular-sized object, it wouldn't be still at all. It would be constantly moving through random thermal motion, through Brownian motion. Yeah.
Right.
And so we have to develop different types of engineering concepts to make machines in the molecular world. We can't just shrink down big machines from our everyday world down to the molecular world. They just wouldn't work.
A couple or 3 years ago, you said that your most exciting discovery at that point was applying Brownian ratchet mechanisms to the design of synthetic molecular structures.
Right.
So since you just mentioned Brownian motion, I seized upon it as something that I vaguely understand. what was that discovery, and does it remain your most exciting?
That was a fantastic thing. So, as I say, the processes that you have to involve in designing molecular level motors are very different to the ones in the big world. You can't shrink a combustion engine down to the molecular world. It wouldn't work. And so what we have to do is use the random motions that are going on in the molecular world anyway, and then ratchet those so that you sort of stop the motions that you don't want, and the only ones left are the motions that you do want. And then the molecules will actually move directionally, which is what you want for a motor, just through Brownian motion that's effectively only incurring in the direction that you want. And so we developed a way of doing that a few years ago, and it's the basis of the molecular machines that we and others have been making ever since.
Is it possible for you to explain to me how you select the ratchet mechanisms and stop the other motions?
Yeah, again, it's actually exactly the same way that biology does that. Biological motors and the motors that we've designed do, they actually, they use information transfer between the components. So when a component moves to a certain position, it tells the motor to erect a barrier behind it so that it can't go backwards. And so the only way that it can then go is forwards. And as it moves a little bit further forward, another barrier comes up behind it, and so on and so forth, meaning that the only way that the Brownian motion occurs is actually to push the things forward.
All right, so you've got molecular machines, have you?
Yes, we've made very simple ones at this stage. So We've got wheels. We've got wheels on axles. We've got motors.
What do you mean you've got wheels on axles?
Yeah. So in order to, we have molecular wheels that can be made to rotate directionally. So just clockwise or just counterclockwise. And the idea
is that what Fraser Stoddart did with the Rotaxane? Rotaxane,
Yes. So Fraser Stoddart is a pioneer in this field, and he was actually the first person to, or one of the first people to actually make these sorts of systems with wheels threaded onto axles. He did that starting at the end of the 1980s and the early 1990s, and Fraser and others, including ourselves, have been working on ways to actually then control the motion of those components, such as using the ratchet mechanisms to make motors and trying to get them to do useful tasks.
So how many molecules would it take to make, you know, wheels and an axle and a motory thing?
To actually assemble them, you just need one wheel and one axle. But the great thing about this sort of technology is that it's not like in the big world where you just take one wheel and put it onto one axle. In the molecular world, because we're using chemistry to assemble these things, we have many, many processes happening in parallel. So we typically make a million of these rings threaded onto axles and motors at a time.
And what holds them together then?
So the things that holds these pieces together, initially it's the way that they're assembled, that the thing that directs the assembly process are things like hydrogen bonding, the same sort of processes that are found in, forces that are found in DNA and in proteins. That's used to direct the assembly of these processes. And then to stop them falling apart again, we mechanically put blocking groups on to stop the components falling apart after they're put together.
Have any of these things engaged with the world yet?
So it's still very early days. It's sort of like asking Stone Age man when he's just made the wheel to sort of predict motor cars and those sorts of and highways and all those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
We're really right at the start. But what we have started to do just in the last 18 months or so is actually make primitive molecular robotic systems, so shrinking robots down to the molecular level. We've made things that can pick up molecular fragments, pass them to another site, put them down again, robotic arms that can do that.
Like assembly line thing.
Exactly. So just as we use robots to build cars on assembly lines in factories, one day we think we'll be able to use this sort of technology, molecular robotics, in molecular factories to build all sorts of molecules and new materials.
I know that Richard Feynman sort of predicted all this back in 1959.
That's right.
In a lecture called There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom, and he talked about molecular machines. Do you think that what is happening now would surprise him, or has it been a kind of predictable evolution?
Oh, definitely not predictable. So Feynman made this famous speech, as you mentioned, at the end of the 1950s, asking really scientists, why haven't you thought of making molecular size machines? And the reason was at that time that the chemistry, the tools that we needed to do that really hadn't been developed, and they only started to be developed at the end of the 1980s and in the 1990s. And that's why we've had this sort of slow ingestion period building up to this now rapid proliferation of things that we're seeing at the moment. But I think Feynman would have been astounded and very pleased, because it's developed it's required the development of a whole new amount of science in order to drive this field forward, which Feynman couldn't have known about, but realised there must be this science out there, because it's what biology uses.
I mentioned knotted molecules in the introduction. You notice I've avoided them so far because they sound ferociously complicated. What are they? What do they do, and how do you make them?
Yeah, so another area of interest of our group is molecular knots, literally tying molecules into knots. And the reason that we got into that area is you use the same sort of forces, the same sort of techniques as you need to put together the components of molecular machines. You can apply the same sort of ideas to knots. So knots, the sort of knots that we've been tying in molecules, are the strands are really, really tiny, just half a nanometer across. So that's 10,000 times thinner than a human hair. And we're able to tie the strands, again, through using chemistry. You can't grab the ends of the strands and mechanically tie them like a shoelace. They're too small. So instead we use chemistry and a process called self-assembly, where we actually get the knots to tie themselves.
You discovered self-assembly a couple of decades or so ago, didn't you?
I can't take the credit for that, I'm afraid.
No, but you see catenanes?
Yes. So we've used the process of self-assembly for the last 2 decades to make interlock molecules such as catenanes, which are really interlocked rings, like the links of a chain. Mm. And again, we use those sorts of techniques in all this assembly of machines and molecular knots.
And the point of it would be what?
Well, I mean, the miniaturisation has been a driving force for amazing advances in technology that we've seen over the last 70 years or so.
But the point of the knots in particular?
Oh, for knots in particular? It's really, again, we've seen that knotting and is very similar to weaving. It's to do with being able to take strands and wrap them around each other in a controlled way. And we've seen historically, again, that knotting and weaving, these sort of technologies in our big world, has had massive impacts on technology. So it allowed a caveman to be able to come out of the cave because he could make fishing nets using knots and tie the blades onto axes, and he could weave fabrics to keep him warm. So knots should be just as important at the molecular level, and woven fabrics at the molecular level, but until we learn how to make them, we're not going to be able to exploit them.
That's not just a metaphor for you, it's a reality that weaving is as valuable at the molecular level as it is at the macro level.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's exactly what we're trying to do. And again, you can think of all the materials, the plastics and the fabrics that we have in our world today. All the molecules in those sorts of materials tend to be just linear strands that are packed together. Imagine if we could weave them at the molecular level, we might get materials that are much more flexible and much stronger and yet much lighter than the ones that we have today. So all these sorts of advances in properties could come if we were able to tie knots in molecules and weave molecular fabrics.
One of your hobbies, I see, is magic.
Yes, so I like to indulge in a little bit of card magic and other kinds of magic, and a little bit of fun and games there. But I think it's also, I like to use it in my science lectures as well, because really sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. There's a famous quote of Arthur C. Clarke's to say that if aliens came to this planet, their technologies would be so advanced that we wouldn't understand them. And so I think that being able to show these sorts of things to scientists, things that they can't necessarily explain, again, it challenges them to maybe think big and act small in the molecular world.
What's your best trick?
I like lots of different sort of visual tricks. My favourite sort of magic is actually close-up things that we do under close-up conditions, where you can really see the magic happening in the spectator's eye, in the spectator's hands. For magic that I do in lectures, that's more stage magic, and I do things like to illustrate self-assembly, the concept I was talking about of bringing building blocks together and forming new sorts of structures. I typically use newspapers to do that, tearing up the bits of a newspaper and then having it go all back together to form a complex structure, which is very much like happens in biology and the sort of things that we do in chemistry.
So you tear up a piece of newspaper and it self-assembles back again?
That's right. And in this assembly of the complex building blocks is a metaphor for exactly what happens in the lab. That's what we're hoping we get the molecules to do, and designing them to do exactly that.
Nice to talk to you. I hope you enjoy the conference.
Thanks for having me, Kim.
I've been talking to Professor David Lee. He's the Royal Society Research Professor, Chair of Chemistry at the University of Manchester.